Okay, good morning, Mr. Wilcox.
Yeah, how you doing?
Now, is the title proper? Is it Mr. Wilcox, Dr. Wilcox?
Just Don. This is
Don.
Preferable.
I just
simple is best for me. It's not Donald, it's just Don, period.
Okay, well, this is Keith Bearden, Texas Tech University, and I'm Vice President of International Phi Beta Mu. And we're doing a project where we're recording our outstanding bandmasters in interview style to post on our website. We're calling it Learn from the Masters. And
I think that's
it. You're one of them. You work hard, and all of a sudden you're a master. And so that's
right.
Well, you were honored in 06, and we were pleased to include you in this list of distinguished directors. And hopefully our younger directors in the profession will log in and listen to your words of wisdom. So let's get started. How did you get started in band when you were little?
Well, my dad was a high school band director in Wewoka, Oklahoma, had a phenomenal band in the 30s and what have you, and competed in all the big national contests with schools like Joliet and Hobart and those. And with a little high school that had about 200 kids in it, and he had 120 in the band. And I grew up around the band room and just idolized my dad and kind of was raised in the band room. And then he was killed in a plane crash when I was 11. And so I got a saxophone and started trying to play clarinet and saxophone and what have you, and wound up playing in a high school band in Chickasha, Oklahoma, that was directed by Paul Enix, who was an ABA member and a marvelous teacher. Paul was just terrific influence, and wound up going from there to Michigan and Ravelli and all of that. So I've run into some good people that had to learn a little bit from occasionally.
Well, that's fantastic. So what year did you start teaching?
I was at Michigan from 54 to 58, and I started in the fall of 58 in Boron, California, which is a big city that's not even on most maps. And the first band I had 18 kids in it, and 9 of them were drummers. And we rehearsed in a corrugated metal bus garage that had a dirt floor in it. We had to move the buses out and stuff and set up on this gravel floor with stands and stuff, and then tear everything down after we got done and put it all, our whole inventory of stands and music and instruments and everything all fit in a garage storage shed that was probably about 8 feet square. So it was we didn't exactly start with a mega band thing, but I was there for 5 years and enjoyed it a lot and learned a lot. On the last concert I did there, we had 5 bands playing with, they built a high school while I was there, and we wound up with 265 kids in the program, and pretty good little band. And I went
after
from there to Anaheim
years.
High School. What?
After five years?
Yeah, I was there for 5 years, and then I went from there to Anaheim High School and followed Bob Reynolds and one other gentleman. There was a fellow there 1 year after Bob, and then I wound up in that job and was there for 3 years and absolutely loved it. That was some of the most enjoyable teaching time I ever remember. The kids at Anaheim were just wonderful. I did an honor band out there last spring, and there were kids there whose grandfather played in the Anaheim band 50 years ago. So it was fun to do. But Anaheim was just delightful. And then I went over to Long Beach as Bob Reynolds' assistant. Then he left and went to Wisconsin, and I wound up inheriting the Long Beach State Band when I was about 30. And wound up going from there to Wichita State for 2 years and then West Virginia for 35.
Wow, that was a great career. And coming out of Michigan, going to that little town, what were your thoughts?
I wanted to go to California. I've always been a car nut, and one of my hobbies has always been racing cars and motorcycles, which I know is not very smart, but I've always enjoyed it. And I figured I could work with band kids anywhere, which fortunately has turned out to be true. So we went to California to start in the band business and race sports cars, and that's where the racing was. And I figured the band kids would be about the same anywhere, and it turned out to be right. So we had a great time out there. We were there for 11 years.
That's wonderful. Now, you were under Ravelli at Michigan, right?
Yes, sir.
Tell us a few stories about that as you were a student in his band.
You got 4 or 5 hours? There's a lot of wonderful tales and all about Ravelli, and most of them are true. And It was a life-changing experience and an introduction to a whole set of musical standards and musical goals that are kind of irreversible and unshakable. The people that played in that band under him kind of come out of there with the Ravelli's idea of what a band is supposed to sound like and what is an acceptable level of pitch and ensemble and so on and all those fundamental things. And you just kind of get it pretty forcefully hammered into you over 4 years. I mean, the band rehearsed 2 hours a day, every day in the world. And you spend a lot of time with a very determined and very, very determined and very knowledgeable conductor. And not much mercy shown if you didn't have the part ready to play.
So when you left Michigan and went to the little small school, did your classes meet each day, or was it after school, or was it in class time?
Well, it was a small enough school that originally when I first went out there, the first year I was there, it was only up through the eighth grade. It was a middle school, and then they built a high school the next couple of years. But it was a very flexible thing. The principal was an old trumpet player, and he liked the band stuff, so I had pretty much free rein to get any kid that I wanted out of class sometime, and so I had band classes all day long and all sorts of things set up for private lessons for kids during the school day and all that, so I had kids going like mad.
Wow, so you didn't have to teach any other classes at that time, just band?
No, I just had band kids going all the time, and I cooked up a deal with some of the other teachers that I'd take their playground duty for them if they let me have the kids out of class occasionally for lessons.
Very innovative. Very
yeah. Well, you do what you need to do.
Absolutely. Do you recall what your starting salary was back then?
$4,600 for a nine-month year.
A little different than it is today. For sure.
Yeah. Fortunately, you make a little more money now, but you could also buy 3 pounds of hamburger for a dollar then, too.
That's right. No, you're exactly right. So we've had several changes through the years. Can you talk about some of the changes you've seen through the years with band programs and comment to the positive impact that's had and maybe some negative impact it's had?
Oh, wow. That's a tough question. That's one we could spend a couple of days on. The evolution of the business, I mean, when I started, it was a one-man operation. You did everything from kindergarten rhythm band through high school. You did the marching band. You did a string program. You did everything. And it has evolved more and more into team teaching and specialization. Now where it's very normal for a school to have a director, an assistant director, and maybe a brass teacher and farm out a lot of the work, and I'm also very aware that there's a lot of marching band guys now who don't chart their own shows or write their own arrangements. It never occurred to me not to do all of that, because that's just kind of the way the business was. You wrote the stuff, you rehearsed it, you charted the drills, you taught the stuff, you did it all yourself.
Right.
And I was amazed to get into college and found out how easy that could be when you had some help.
So that's positive. We've added staff and facilities and budgets, and that's all grown. And
the financial end of it is very critical. One of the things that I always tried to encourage my students to do is to be incredibly careful about the things that are non-musical, that deals with purchasing procedures and budgets. And I've known very few band directors who got fired for being a lousy musician, but I've known a lot of them that have been fired for messing up a budget procedure or finding money that they can't account for or that sort of thing. So
absolutely right. So the changes that I mean, it's been a whirlwind of changes the past 50 years. And do you see anything that's negative in some of the things that are going on today? Current trends?
Well, I think so. Sometimes there's a loss in some cases of the direct personal contact between the head band director in a lot of places and the kids in the second or third band and what have you. We wind up kind of in some places with sort of a star system where the head director in a big high school or a small college or whatever kind of focuses on the best handful of kids and a top wind ensemble perhaps, and doesn't really have the day-to-day contact with the kids on the bottom of the chain. And those of us that started teaching everything from kindergarten rhythm band through classes and classes and classes of beginners. There's a connection between that lower level work that I think most really good band directors still enjoy doing that and find it important. I mean, working with the second band or the worst kids in the program shouldn't get farmed out as, you know, like send a grad assistant to do that and never go see them.
Right.
I think there's a contact there. One of the things that I always kept my hand in the marching band at WVU as long as I was there. I did it entirely with assistant help for probably close to 30 years. But towards the end, I turned the marching band over to John, and I kind of worked as his assistant. But I stayed very active with the marching band, partly because you meet every incoming freshman music major in that context. They all come in. They want to play in a marching band because it's big and famous and all that. And you wind up getting a direct contact with every freshman kid from the day they come in the school. And you get literally a head start with the incoming freshman. You know them before anybody else does. You get done with a week of band camp, and you know every incoming freshman, and they kind of stay with you until they graduate. They may be, you know, 2 degrees later. But
right.
You know them, you know, in so many classes, you have a kid for one semester and you do what you can and they go on to somebody else. But in the band program, you've got a kid for 4 or 5 years and you get to know them inside out and backwards. You wind up knowing their family. You wind up dealing with a crisis with them or one thing and another. And I mean, I've had kids in the band where I would be best man at a wedding or give some girl away because her dad was killed in a mine accident or something like that, give her away at her wedding because, it, you know, sort of surrogate father and all that. My wife and I have 4 kids, and we've had band kids in and out and through our house for all our lives. I mean, we sort of semi-adopt most of them. And
right.
all the cliche things about it's a big family, really kind of is. There's a true side to that, but you have to know the kids, know who they are, and be directly involved with them rather than just focus on the top recording ensemble. And when you guys get good enough to get in that group, I'll talk to you. And that, I think, is a negative.
And the same thing happens in high school with the disconnect sometimes with middle school kids. You know, if you want them to play in your band, you need to know who they are.
Yep. One of the things that I when I was teaching Anaheim High School, I made it at least once every week, I would set foot in the junior high band rooms of the guys, and I did not want a junior high band kid in one of the feeders there to ever look up when I walked in a room and say, "Who's that?" I mean, it was like, "Oh, it's him again."
Right.
It's the guy from the high school. I can't remember what his name is, but he's the guy at the high school. And
Wayne, you're going
in. Yeah, and you wind up where they feel like you're a familiar object, and you wind up, you know, talk to them and establish that contact. So when they go from junior high to high school, they don't quit. They think, "Oh, I know the high school band. It's good. I know this guy." So I'm not. There's a big disconnect between junior high and high school a lot of times because of schedules and busyness and busy kids and everything else. If you're going to lose them, you usually lose them from one school to another, from grade school to junior high, or from junior high to high school, or from high school to college. And bridging that gap is half the job in a high school. If you don't get those good junior high kids all the time and get all the good ones, you're sunk.
Right. And what you said you were involved, and this is good, with the marching band the entire career at WVU. And what do you feel about the current trends in high school marching bands?
I think probably that some of the contest levels are so advanced and so sophisticated that it is no longer a matter of, we have a high school band that performs on Friday nights for the games, let's get together Saturday and play for each other and see who's got the best band. I mean, it's now come down to a point to where careers are advanced or jobs won and lost on marching band contests that are with a show written by somebody for a lot of money off scale, arrangements written by somebody you don't know, and drill taught by a drill guy who you hire someplace, and the guard all taught by a guard instructor, and the band director is kind of the chairman of the board operating a corporation rather than a teacher dealing directly with the kids. And that disconnect, I think, is a problem. The level of sophistication is fantastic. I mean, I enjoy the level of performance, but I think there's a danger in it becoming, you know, we start on this show in the summertime and we do one show forever and get it just gloriously perfect, but does that not have a couple of side things that may not be positive?
Time will tell. It's going to do a lot of burnout. I'm feeling with directors and see it already.
Well, there's a huge positive side, and there's also very, very possibly a pretty good sized negative one that is easily lost in the energy and the enthusiasm of a big trophy and a big triumph and the praise that comes with one of these great, very sophisticated bands. It's easy to kind of lose focus on one of the things. Just as a comment, my high school band at Anaheim, we rehearsed the marching band before school. The kids used to come in at 7 in the morning and rehearse the marching band. Our band period, which was the first part of the day, was always, even completely through football season, was always spent on concert music. We started on serious sit-down and concert stuff, and we had three concert bands going. We had marching band with all the kids before school started. Then when school started, we had three band rehearsals with concert stuff from day one, every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it made a whale of a difference in the way kids played, and it's just a different thing. I mean, if you make your decisions and you focus your teaching effort and your energy and your time on what you consider is the most important. And
right.
The most important thing to me was I love the marching band. I enjoy the energy and the vitality and the personal contact of it. I like to teach marching band. I run around on the field in the middle of the kids and stuff and all of that. But the main focus is sit down inside and how well can you play.
Right. That's where what it comes down to.
Yeah,
that
does,
out
does to me anyway. You can't, you know, how nice a sound can you make and how much music can you make out of that phrase and find something beyond the notes. I have one of my favorite soapboxes with my conducting kids was more than the notes. Find, you know, the notes are not the music. The notes are the mechanics. That's the blueprint and the house plans, but you can't live in it. The music is something you have to make every time.
Your recipe for success obviously has been outstanding. And what, if you look back over your career, what was a personal highlight of your career?
Oh, there have been so many, you couldn't hardly imagine it. But the some of them are so odd. The when I was out at Boron in that first 5 years, trying to make contact with a community that had almost no normal middle class. The town was centered near Edwards Air Force Base, so we had a handful of rocket scientists, literally, and the other part of the town, most of it, functioned with the gigantic borax mine, so we had people that were driving trucks at the mine or rocket scientists or that sort of thing. There was no middle class, and trying to build a program there was very strange, and some of the things I did were bizarre trying to gain some interest in that. And one of the things that finally broke through a little bit was doing Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. For some reason, they loved doing that, and we would do one in the gym every semester, and I'd get everybody in town involved, and we had a local Baptist minister who loved to always play the villain, and I'd get the kids in the school to sing, and I'd write all the orchestra parts for the pit for the band kids, and we'd do these goofy Gilbert and Sullivan operettas, and we'd just fill the gym up doing that. And it was a goofy thing to do, but in that case it worked. And Anaheim was delightful. I was only there for 3 years. I would have been happy to spend my entire career at that school. I love the kids, and the school was just beautifully run, and there was a camaraderie and an esprit de corps in that high school that was just magical at that time. And And then going to Long Beach State, I met all these wonderful, talented people at Long Beach. I mean, we had people like Alan McMurray was my first trumpet player, and he's done pretty well at Colorado. And Gene Corporon was my first clarinet player for a while. And players like that, it just, we had some great kids there, you know, and musicianship in that L.A. area, there was just a goldmine of talent there that the players were wonderful. I enjoyed that a lot. The only reason I left there was because my wife and my son, who was just an infant at that time, were both having a really strong negative reaction to the smog in L.A. There was something in the smog that was very hard on my wife and my son, and they were having all kinds of breathing problems dealing with that, and I got a call out of the blue offering me the job at Wichita State. And I figured if there's any place that's got fresh air, it's Wichita, and having grown up in Oklahoma, I figured I could recruit pretty good in there. So I went to Wichita for 2 years, and they changed deans, and the dean didn't like me, so I got run out of there. But it turned out to be a good thing because I wound up in West Virginia, and that worked out very well. But there's been a lot of highlights, and one of the main ones would be doing the very first WASB convention in Manchester, England in 1981. My band played for that. And Alan McMurray's band from Colorado played for that, too. So there were five American bands there, and one of them was mine, and one of them was a great kid who had been a former student of mine.
That's
so that was kind of fun. And we did a concert one night, and they did one night. And then on the end of both of them, we put the two wind ensembles together and did a large symphonic band piece. And so that was kind of fun to do. But there's been a lot of stuff like that. And main highlight, I think, also is I've always liked to travel, see what was over the next hill and all that sort of thing. And the band business has allowed me to do that and actually get paid for it most of the time. I've had a chance to conduct bands in all 50 states and 24, 25 foreign countries and enjoy that.
It's an amazing achievement. Do you have a favorite composition that you've liked to use over the years?
There's lots of them, but ironically, I was just talking to one of my kids about that the other day, and after thinking about all sorts of things, I think what I told my daughter was Granger Colonial Song. If they had to pick a tune to play at my funeral, I think that'd be it.
Well done. Yes. What about?
I've got a recording of that I did in Japan with the wind ensemble from Musashino that I think is pretty decent.
I'm sure it is.
Anyway, I like that piece a lot.
Who were some of the old masters during the early years? You've mentioned some. Are there any others that you looked up to, and other than Ravelli, of course?
Oh, well, Ravelli was the king of the hill at that point and what have you. But we played, when I was a freshman at Michigan, we played the ABA convention in Elkhart, Indiana that spring, and we had the guest conductors included Harding, and we played under Hinesley at various times, and we had Carl King and Henry Fillmore conduct the band back-to-back on a couple of their marches. Paul Creston was there and conducted the premiere of a Celebration Overture, I think, and they're just... William F. Sandelman conducted a tune on that concert, and all through growing up, I mean, I played the Oklahoma All-State Band for 4 years, and the conductors in that were all ABA guys. I remember Ray Dvorak did that group 1 year, and we had in a rehearsal at one point, and we had that famous artificial right arm with a cable set up on it and everything that he conducted with. And the cable broke, and his right arm just kind of swung down like helpless. And they had to find a cable replacement to get it where he'd work. And it was really kind of goofy. He had probably the best opening line for an all-state band of anybody I've ever heard. He got on the podium, and we're all sitting there, and he said he was very happy to be in Oklahoma. He always felt right at home there because part of him was buried around there somewhere. And he told us that he'd lost an arm and one leg in a train wreck on his way to Enid, and part of him was buried around there someplace.
Oh, that's a funny story.
Certainly get the kids' attention.
Absolutely. Well, we have a lot of young directors coming into the profession, and would you like to offer them, what is your biggest tidbit of advice that you might offer new directors beginning their careers?
Oh, my. How many hours have you got? The most of the advice that I would have is kind of long range, like enjoy the ride. Some of the happiest, most fulfilling teaching you will ever do may be in the first job you have. I mean, when you see a kid's eyes light up or his face change, like, oh, that's how that works. I got it. I understand that. That's what you teach for, and that can happen when you least expect it sometime, and that's what makes it all worthwhile, is when that kid plays a phrase that makes him feel, and you can see on his face, like, that was really pretty, you know, and something as simple as that is what it's about, and if you don't look for that and see a little of that every day, it's easy to kind of miss the point of what's going on.
Absolutely.
And
that's the importance. You
don't teach music, you teach kids, you teach students. The subject matter is music, but, you know, don't teach notes, teach kids, and you teach them how to think and how to feel and how to play a trumpet or whatever. But teaching them how to play a trumpet is only part of it. If you don't teach beyond that, then you miss a point.
The common thread among all these interviews is that first job. And I think that's because we got into that first job and had some success and discovered that, hey, we can do this business.
Yeah, this is kind of fun. I went out to California really split between I'm either going to be a band director or race cars professionally. And I had an opportunity to do both. And the job at Anaheim is what changed that. And that's when, like, This is what I want to do. I love these kids, and they just, I still hear from kids that played in that band 50 years ago.
Right, and if you teach the kids first and see those smiles, that turns into the trophies that you think you're after, when it's not really that important. The smiles over trophies.
And sometimes it's not even smiles. Sometimes they're kind of ticked off at you for making them do something, but underneath they feel like, well, I'm glad I did that.
And they appreciated in long years after that.
Yeah, there's just so much. I was talking to the band yesterday before our concert, and I was giving them some last ideas and things, and I found myself quoting Elizabeth Green from Michigan and talking about having played Elsa's Procession of the Cathedral one time under Lucien Collier, who did the transcription with the Michigan band on tour, and he came up and conducted that, and experiences like that that you just never get over. Or I think one of the things that's been so neat is having the contact with people like Aaron Copland, who we had in for a week and did everything he ever did for band and what have you, and he did some rehearsals with my group and things, some experiences with him that were very special. And we had Morton Gould there at one time, and he was rehearsing the symphony, West Point Symphony. And we had several people that came in and were listening and what have you. And a guy walked in the door and was standing over in the corner, and Morton Gould stopped right in the middle of anything and ran over toward this guy and gave him a big hug, and then came back and apologized to the band for stopping right in the middle of the tune. But he said, do you people know who that is? And nobody had any idea who this guy was. And he said, that is Herb Morrison, who lives here in Morgantown, and I haven't seen him in 30 years or something. And he was my one of my best friends when I first got started in NBC as a staff arranger and what have you around the radio station. And if you don't know who that is, he lives here in town and you don't even know him. And he said, you've all heard his voice. He was the guy who was the announcer live when the Hindenburg blew up.
My, my.
And the humanity. He's the guy who said that. And he was standing there in the room. And none of us knew it. and, you know, things like that that just feel like, I'm glad I was there when that happened.
Yes, those things.
And we keep having things like that that happen to us all the time in this business. I mean, you experience stuff like that, and we all get a chance to do that, and it's just, you know, it's a great business. I always said it was way more fun than actually having to work for a living.
Absolutely. Let's sum it up with a final thought for our interview and a word of wisdom to those new folks out there.
Well, just keep at it and keep doing it. When I first started, I thought I was pretty good. When I'd been doing it for a while, I thought maybe I could get to be pretty good. And then I got to the point to where I hope I can go through the rest of my career without messing up too many kids. And then now I feel like I'd rather wear out than rust out. I'll be 80 in the spring, and we did 14 concerts this summer, so I'm still trying to figure out how it works.
Fantastic. Well, I think you've done it. Thank you so much for your time, and this will be posted on our international site, and it'll be there in infamy. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Keith. Come up and see us sometime.
I will do it. Thank you, Don.
You bet. Bye-bye.